Welcome, everyone. I'd like to call to order the September 4th, 2025 Facility Standards Manual Public Review Committee meeting. No members are permitted or participating remotely, and committee members disclose they are members of one or more affected groups, and their respective declarations of interest are kept on file in the minutes of the Facility Standards Manual Public Review Committee. How are these taken care of? Have anyone, if they don't have public comments, are they correct?
Correct.
Laura said that there was a couple of comments on our minutes from the July meeting. Let her go over those.
Yes. Quickly, back to the beginning here. So the first, I'm going to make this bigger. Get this one's big. I'm backing. So this text was requested to be added through this bullet that talks about changes to the existing grade, removal of excavated material, and the declaration of no effective floodplain be reinstated by adding it as permitted examples, but not limited to, in the no rise, no impact certification. So that's the suggested addition there. And the next bullet, staff noted that FEMA is not capturing minor boundary changes that cannot be caught on the berm due to the scale and line thickness. I just have to say scale. And Maggie, can you help me? What should I write for firm? Was that abbreviation?
Flood insurance right now.
Thank you. I'd rather write it out because I don't think I use it anywhere else. Instead of saying the 5 feet specific, just generalize that. And obviously staff can jump in too. You guys think I'm making it wrong. Please let me know. The next comment was here under the committee member inquired. It goes on to say, noting that driveway and private culvert crossings are addressed as a type 1 floodplain alteration without a floodplain study. And the next bullet, the benefit of using hecgrass with a type 1 floodplain alteration. That here that's changed. A committee member inquired if a type 1 floodplain alteration would be required. The items previously submitted through the declaration narrative in FSN 5441 were no longer going to be permitted under the new no rise no impact certification. I might think it'll be used for them. Required if a type 1 would be required, the items previously permitted declaration were no longer permitted. Okay. I got it. Sorry. Under your advice. I got it. And that's it. So if everybody's agreeing for those changes, or if you have any other changes, we would need a motion to approve the minutes as amended.
Motion to approve. Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Drew, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Okay, we're going to start off the meeting today with the continuing our conversation about Chapter 8 floodplain amendments. I'm going to try to stop cleanly at 4 o'clock so we have adequate time to address the 10-year private road preserve fund topic.
So two things. One, I'm going to introduce Gwen in just a minute. She's going to give you an update. but one, I wanted to let you all know, and I mentioned in the email, but you didn't see it. We are pausing our review of the Chapter 5 floodplain amendments. There were some questions that were raised at the July meeting, and staff is still following up, doing research on those items. So we elected to move forward into Chapter 8 and go ahead and do that review. And when we're done with the Chapter 8 review, we're planning to circle back to the Chapter 5 discussion. So it's not gone. It's just paused for a little bit. And then with that, I want to let Glenn Kennedy, our Natural Resources Division Manager, provide an update on, I know she was following up on.
Yeah, so if you guys recall, any of the last meeting, there were some discussions about potential uses, interested in uses related to single family, multifamily, accessory structures. And so I did bring that up to Zoc yesterday. So we had a Zoc meeting. And as part of that discussion, they did give us some direction to go back and look at that to see if there's any potential language changes for that to add. Basically, things like dog houses, gardens, like your Costco playground type of things. So Megan had brought that up in the meeting, and part of our discussion was that there were anything related to Zoc that I would be the conduit to bring that forward. And so I had a conversation with the chair and vice chair, and so I brought it up in committee yesterday. So so we are going to, as staff, go back and look at that and evaluate it. And we are supposed to bring something back to Zoc at a later date. So we will be doing that. And then there was just a generally also just let you know, there was a discussion about active recreation in the floodplain for that particular use. I'm not exactly sure what the final motion was, because generally what the final, they did a different option than what we had presented, but generally the final motion was to recommend to the board that a legislative process begin to look at active recreation in both floodplain and risk for associated with major floodplain. So we will be going to the board October 7th to have a conversation about active recreation in the major floodplain and risker. And from there, we'll just see where the board wants us to go. But that was the recommendation from Zoc that will be presented at that meeting.
Oh, Zoc's recommendation.
Yes, Zoc's recommendation. Yeah. So staff has a different recommendation than that. But that's what Zoc's recommendation. So.
This is Jason real quick. I'd also add that I think that some of Zoc, they're not clearly understanding what exactly the status quo is as to what is permitted in the floodplain regarding active rec. We worked on this as the PRC at least twice in the last decade. And again, any kind of active rec that... And regardless of restrictions on permeable surface, any kind of active rec that causes a change to the boundary or a rise or any change to base flood elevation is a special exception use under the current text. And I think that's something that Zoc is not understanding. And so right there, 99% of what you can do in the FOD regarding active rec is going to be a special exception use already. And so that's some of what I'm hearing from Zoc is I don't think they quite grasp, or certain members don't grasp that. And what I would say is, you know, that's been the status quo for 10 years. I'm not aware it's been causing any problems. And I think that how we redrafted, refined the language 10 years ago, generally implemented what was in effect prior to that too. So, you know, it's, I'm not really understanding what the sudden concern or urgency is that some Zoc members are expressing regarding that.
Anybody have any questions for me?
Yeah,
I thought the issue was with it was removing any active work.
Like, not even the new language was suggesting even there's no avenue with a special exception to have active rec. That's keeping the status quo. Seems there's doing the same thing the last 20 years, so
yeah,
seems fine.
Yeah, so there's a whole, if you go and look up the whole presentation, hopefully it should be post it or I'll ask them to post it. But in general, there were changes that there's a discrepancy between risker and in floodplain right now. So we are trying to figure out how to solve that. The way to solve that is either that we align the floodplain regulations with the zoning ordinance and current comp plan, which only allows active recreation in the minor floodplain. It does not allow it in major floodplain for risker. Right. Or we have to update the risker and the floodplain to be the same by allowing it. So it has to be married, because we do not want a situation, because it does not make logical sense, to allow it in floodplain but not allow it in risker and then allow it again. Doesn't make any sense, right? We need to have consistency between what risker and what floodplain has, and that is a board decision for the board to make a policy decision on what they want to do. So that is what we will bring. And we have different options, you know, special exception is an option, you know, just doing what we had already talked about originally, which is, you know, marrying it with the current CPAM, or there's the option of changing the CPAM, doing a CPAM and a ZOR to basically change the risk of regulation.
Right. I guess my understanding was there wasn't a special exception option to have active rec in the risker, which made it hard for lots that were part risker, part floodplain.
You're right. That's correct. It's not allowed currently. Yeah.
So whatever the result is, we have to fix one or the other.
Right.
So if we decide that we're going to keep the current floodplain standards, which is for special exceptions, then we have to do a CPAM and a ZOR update risker.
I think there was also some noted in our joint meeting that it wasn't just active rec, where there's also inconsistencies with like utilities, where some could be in the RSCR, some could be in the floodplain. So I don't think it's just one application. I think it's other line items and the permitted use in between the two.
We were proposing to add for the floodplain, and that was in conflict with RSCR, so we just removed the proposed changes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember what the items were. I just remember that being brought up. But I appreciate you bringing up the accessory stuff.
Well, again, we had the discussion. I said I would do it, and I did. So we talked about it. So again, I think as staff, we're going to go back and look at it and see if something makes sense and evaluate it from a staff perspective of what we would recommend. And then also, I mean, SOP will have input on what they think should happen. So,
real quick, I know this is not a debate for the zoning ordinance, and I don't want to go down that path. You just mentioned that Zoc's position was X. You said that was not staff's position, but then you didn't provide staff's position. Is educated on
what? Yeah. So staff's position on it is currently. I'll say we're going to talk about it, but staff's position on it that we presented at the meeting was that we want to marry it with the current comp plan. So the comp plan currently with the risker basically says the active recreation is only allowed in minor floodplain. So we want to marry the floodplain regulations with that. That is what already the board has made a determination about, right, through a public process, right? The comp plan was public process. The ZOR was a public process. This was what came out of that. So our recommendation would be to marry those two things. So as you know, as part of any board item, everyone knows that there will be the recommendation from SOC will be present, but we will have a staff recommendation, which may or, you know, sometimes agrees with the committee and sometimes it's not. So,
yeah. When you say Mary, with what the board, that was about the whole adoption of risker, was that
correct? Yeah. Maybe consistent with the languages, yeah.
Is there, I can't remember. Is there like a, I know we've got that minimum setback with risker. Is the rules different for active rec when it has to do outside of the minimum buffer, but within the floodplain? It's still technically risker, but floodplain. Does that change anything?
Tony Gordon has a question.
Yeah, we gotta go back and look.
I don't believe so, Megan. I think it's if you're in the risker, I don't think it does anything differently versus buffer or non-buffer.
Hey, so am I to understand under the current comp plan then that you could not build another golf course along the Potomac River, along Goose Creek?
For the comp plan.
Correct.
Has anybody figured that part out? I mean, that's where golf courses belong.
Well, I think golf courses now are special exceptions to the floodplain.
But you, well, what I just heard was no active recreation in a major floodplain. So the likes of Lowe's Island, the Trump Golf Course, River Creek, Goose Creek, if it's ever reconstructed by the developer, those golf courses wouldn't be allowed anymore. And we're losing golf courses everywhere.
We're going to, we have language, or we will have language that talks about nonconformity.
I believe, so this all originally started in 2004 with the CPM. So this isn't even from the most current, like it's carried over for years. And I believe in 2004, they had a revision that said golf courses could be allowed with a special exception. So it's possible, the 2019 does not have that language as far as I'm aware, but it's possible that there could be some. That was something that they talked about originally. Doesn't it seems like maybe they talked about it and said if they didn't want it in there in 2019. So, I mean, it's been something that's discussed and vetted through the public process. And I think that was the result, is they didn't want them in a major floodplain or associated with Mr.
I would just make a sidebar comment that just because something has been through a public process, the fact that it was brand new and nobody had ever applied a risker theory, they mean that there needs to be adjustments. It's hard to fully comprehend the impact of something until you work with it.
Well, they had RISCOD. So these were all
thrown out.
Right. So. They had a couple of years where they worked with RISCOD, and I think part of those were they had another CPAM that came through after the initial RISCOD. And I think that's those revisions, to your point, came from kind of realizing. So originally, in the original comp plan, it said active rec only swimming and boating. And then they brought in a 2004 revision to increase what uses were allowed in that risker area.
Using non-gasoline boats and kayaks and canoes and like Goose Creek, does our major floodplains constitute as active rec?
So is that a question?
Yes, I think we're going down the zoning path.
Yes,
yeah, where we need to go. We need to divide it up and go back to the FSM because that's where we're at. We'll be at the board on the 7th. Public, I assume there's public comments.
Yes, public comments.
Certainly come and listen or make public comments and add that.
Would you like us to proceed?
Yes, please.
Okay. So, I will admit this is confusing. This is a red line, and most of this red line is what's proposed in DOAM 2025-0002, which is kind of smorgasbord. It's the second part of the ZOR amendments, when we're three, right? It is stormwater amendments for the new handbook, and it is PSR amendments to change the timing of staff preparation of PSRs for 30 to 60 days. So, that's kind of what most of this red line is. That DOAM is going to a September 23rd Planning Commission public hearing, and hopefully it will be at the board public hearing adopted in November, and will be in the like a January 1st, 26th FSM update, okay? So once the board adopts this, I can turn most of this red line so that you can really see the floodplain DOAM pages, but for now I kind of had to resort to green highlight to show you like the background is the current DOAM that's processing, and then the green will be what we will have to change with the floodplain DOAM. As you can imagine, most of these changes are like taking out FOD because we will not have an overlay district and we'll go to floodplain. So that's kind of the introduction and why we're looking at just green pages today. With the exception of 8104 and 8105, because that's all floodplain. So the first thing here, let me tell you where I am. I'm in 8100, which are the general standards. This is details of plan requirements. In this new section we created with the DOAM processing now, zoning overlay districts we had standards for plats and plans. One of the standards for plats was, yeah, that's for plats, was to show the boundaries of the FOD. So we are going to edit that to remove FOD.
Move that whole section or?
Yeah, unfortunately, so what happens when I try to put a comment to correspond with it, and when I comment, it's gray. So all of the green and gray in what was subset triple I will be deleted. If I scroll up, you can kind of see, because this is overlay districts.
Yep.
And floodplain is no longer up to. Megan's like, we got it, move on. Okay. I'm rusty, I was on a break. All right, so let me look at my list. The next page is 12. Instead of scrolling, I'm going to try to jump and tell you where I am. All right, so I'm at 12. This is 8102, preliminary plats of subdivision. And there was text in here. And you might remember, we tried to edit this once before, and we were unsuccessful at editing it. So we said, we'll push that to the floodplain domain. So here we are. This says approximate water course locations and names, if any, floodplain boundary, and floodplain easements in accordance with Chapter 5 of this manual. Well, this is the key part. The floodplain boundary shall be as shown in LOGIS unless a floodplain study or floodplain alteration has been approved, in which case the floodplain boundary of the approved study or alteration will be shown. So the default is LOGIS, but if you have something better, we want the something better. And you'll see this repeated over and over. You're going to get tired of seeing this. It's the theme. You're going to see this multiple times. You'll be like, we reviewed that. We just reviewed that. But just humor me for a minute.
So normally how this goes, right, is if we don't know, we'll get a comment on the review that says, that here's the approved floodplain study, right? The county will provide that.
Yeah, if the information just says, you know, what on LOGIS, and we know of better information, we'll make a comment that provides the number of information.
And what I'm asking though is, does the county assist with providing the information?
Like the actual data?
Yeah.
Okay. Does the floodplain on LOGIS get updated when you get these alterations?
It will, once we get the zoning ordinance.
It doesn't currently.
Currently, offsite changes are not incorporated into LOGIS.
What do you mean offsite?
So if you do, mostly it's for studies, but if there's a study, you have to go a certain number of feet up and downstream, and sometimes that takes into account properties that aren't part of like the project.
Okay.
Those properties do not have the floodplain updated on them in LOGIS.
Okay, but the property, the subject of the application, would eventually get updated on so someone else could see it.
But once we get this done to get out of the overlay, we will be able to just update with all the new data.
There also, I mean, there is a delay too. So just in the event that it happens to not be updated yet.
It's probably not like a 5-year delay. So
no.
If you didn't, Brandon, that wasn't aware of it on application, it's probably something pretty recent.
Yeah.
Are you guys retroactively going back to old applications to make that fix on those adjoining properties?
Still working through the process, it's going to look like.
So the language changes, the question is originally saying that it needs to be shown once submitted and under review, and it had changed to officially approved boundary. So as a open study or alteration, needs to be approved before you can submit your preliminary plat, or?
No, we're not changing that. You show LOGIS.
Until approval goes through.
Promise we're not doing that. Hey, we're not going to require a group floodplain study before you submit a floodplain.
Yeah. Unless you want to provide a proof.
I mean, I'm sure that's right.
But, okay. Just the way it was worded, I don't know if that would be like a checklist item, you know, like, oh, not approved again.
No, what we didn't want is, like you said, today it says submitted. They didn't want that. They wanted it to be either LOGIS or approved. No middle ground. Because there could still be comments on the submitted one. It's like an awkward middle ground. So we're going to go to that.
So we're not required to provide an updated study by that point.
It's saying if there is a approved study, you will show out. Okay. That is the intent of the language. So you show low just unless there's vestibule information already approved. Yeah.
8103, I just want to show you the footer before I go down. It's going to be the same text, but it's important because you got to know what application I'm talking about. And here I'm talking about 8103, which is plats for subdivision and other miscellaneous plats. And you're going to see here, it just said water courses and names, if any. So we've sort of, again, same language, it's consistent. Approximate water course location and names. And then again, show it per LOGIS or unapproved. Study or alteration. This was very difficult to word. Jason helped us out a lot on this because I had it reverse. I had what we would prefer first, which is the approved study for alteration. And then, but if you don't have that, do LOGIS. But I really felt like he landed in the right place that you all would prefer to say LOGIS unless you have an approved. It was more intuitive and I felt like he did a good job because this would be more what would make sense for committee and for development community. So
should be shall be shown per LOGIS instead of in LOGIS.
Language
shall be as shown.
Shall be LOGIS.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's fine. I think that's we got that from like previous. Figure out 18, 35. Big jump. Big jump to 35. 35. Whoop. Okay, this is 813.6 easement plats, creation of a nuisance. As you might recall, we do this a lot. The 8103 applications that don't reference 8103 itself, like 6, 7, and 8, all have to have their own individual language because it's not incorporated by cross reference. So we're going to repeat that same language here. And we added the source of floodplain note to this C8101 because we didn't have it. But it's again the same language. So and then 40. I'm telling you 40 is going to be the 8103.7 Deddies, dedication and vacation plats. Similar edits to the previous section, it's going to be that language plus the source of floodplain note on the Deddy. And then 45 is, I'll tell you what it is, it's the AR1, AR2 division plats, SBBB. In this case, we already have the source of floodplain note, but we're adding the language about what you show for floodplain note. Now we're going to slow down just for a minute because we're going to get into 8104 and 8105. So these are our floodplain study and operation sections. So we're going to slow down a smidge. So what you're seeing in blue here is new. Okay, we don't just do green here. This is floodplain edits because, as you can imagine, in the SOAR implementation, we didn't have any edits here. There wasn't much to do. So the first thing is just to be consistent with other sections, to have a header, lead in sentence, and then say A is plan requirements. That's just typical. This yellow in number 7 is part of the current DOAM. So that's a change that's already being made, not part of the floodplain DOAM. Okay, so this is a change. Number 15, a narrative describing the basis of the map change.
That has a question.
Yes.
Are other applications have the acronym? No longer one for floodplain study.
I think that might be a landmark thing. Is there no longer?
Both studies and alterations are now FLPO. We don't have a distinction between a study and an alteration in landmark.
It is registered that way. Yeah.
But should we at least say what it?
No.
Same
with plans.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's not versus plans. Plans.
I don't disagree with you at all.
We went from having way too many.
He's asking, should it have that FLPL? But then it's like E-plan. Then you go into your work class and you think, oh, I'm really doing a site plan. I'm really doing a C-plan. But you don't, you have a word class under the F?
Yeah, we have word classes.
Do you have FPSC?
No, it's just all three.
Yeah, just all three should play, all three should teach.
So there's no special word class acronym.
I think that back to the landmark task force.
That's a dumb question about something that you guys already covered. The number of sheets composing the plan, is that like you've got a 3A out of 7? Really, you have 8 sheets and not 7, so you want to see something labeled as 8 sheets? Or is it just 7 out of 7? You don't really care. Your dialogue.
That's a good question. I think it's just sheet numbering, but.
I'd say like sheet index then.
Yeah, I get that comment sometimes, and I'm like, what am I done differently depending on who the comments on
it? Yeah, like, what does it say? Like,
it's a legend.
Plan requirements.
This is the floodplain study plan requirement.
Wait, what about just regular plan?
Oh, like in the 106? Give me a second.
We can just in it.
It says sheet index, including the number of sheets in the plan. That's what it says. It says sheet index, comma, including the number of sheets in the plan.
Hey, I'll read it to you one more time. I'm sorry. Sheet index is index capitalized?
Awesome. Yep. Including the number of sheets in the plan.
Number of sheets, and it's in the plan.
Yeah. Which doesn't help me. Question of what number do you mean?
So technically, we have a lot of detail on this in our electronic plan submission guidelines. You can learn everything you want to know by looking at that document, and I can send the link out to everybody about how we want you to number things. Like, if it's EMS sheets, we want, like, a prefix. And
oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I will send it out to everybody.
So we're not doing simple ones and twos.
No, it's like C-dash, ES-dash, G-dash.
Well, you asked. See, this is the thing. You asked.
Don't worry, guys. They're just kind
of... You could be rejected, but I've never been.
What is that?
I digress. Okay, so then we're back to the narrative. 15 was the narrative. Okay, moving on. 18 is the plan, rural to scale, and so that is through here. C, instead of location of streams, we've changed streams to natural man-made open channels and ponds to water bodies. A lot of this was Jason's input. He felt like this was more accurate, and staff agree. So you'll see these changes kind of consistent.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then, again, stream became channel invert. Then here, under profiles, it just says existing and proposed crossings of the floodplain. Get road. 20 is delineation of any existing floodplain easements. And 21 is, instead of a specified in, it says in accordance with Chapter 5. B is the items to accompany floodplain studies, and it has a lead-in. The following items shall accompany the initial submission of the floodplain study. And you'll see this again in the next section, but in 1C, it's clarified digital files, hydrologic, and hydraulic models, and supporting data in georeference format with each submission. Tech RAS files shall include the RAS terrain files info layer. That's with submission. And then you'll see in number 2, this is the following shall be required prior to approval of the floodplain study. It's very similar to the setup in like CPAPs or Cypress. And A is digital files of the base map layers, topography, existing or planned, parcel boundaries, water course centerline, water course cross section, and the floodplain boundary shall be spatially referenced and provided in ESRI shapefile format AutoCAD DWG format may also be provided if the ESRI shapefile format is available. And then in B, we have the documentation of the property owner notification. If the floodplain study results in any change in the base flood elevation and or change the boundaries of the floodplain, provide copies of the individual notifications sent to all property owners affected by the change.
Okay. So the process for minor and major is a little different. For major, we have to go through a LOMAR with FEMA. They don't want us sending out notifications until they've reviewed and approved the letter that's being notified. So I think this could mislead people to send out notifications with FEMA. Approves it.
That's what we want though, because right now for a property owner notification, like this is separate of the FEMA process. So we have our own mapping process, right? Like when you look at the floodplain maps, we have our floodplain maps. Then you have FEMA's maps that get updated through their process. So if we want to update WebLogic, we have to notify property owners before we can make that update to WebLogic. So that is what this notification is for. It's for major floodplain, minor floodplain, your floodplain was being changed because of the study. Here it is. And then there's an additional process.
Right. So I'm just going to give one of the examples that you were involved in. When the town had asked us to notify individuals before it went to FEMA, then the town got so nervous they wouldn't sign the MT2 forms. And they got FEMA involved, and FEMA had said, we have our notification process, and now in order to accept this application, it was a lot more involved. Like, the county process, because we're, like, right on that cusp, county process didn't require us to do the public notification prior to FEMA, and it created a lot of drama. There's still input allowed once you notify them after it's gone to FEMA, but FEMA then structures that letter in the way they want notified to people to lessen the overreactions or misunderstandings, because they have a specific format that they want to communicate, and it raised a lot of issues of the way it was communicated and what was said. And I just see this being an issue as well, because everyone freaks out over notifications. And so if they still get the notification, it's just following the FEMA template.
But that means that we wouldn't be able to update if we went. So first of all, that doesn't account for minor.
Right.
So we would still need something for minor.
Right. I'm not worried about that.
But so the other thing for major floodplain, though, is that we couldn't update WebLogis until
after FEMA approves it.
Correct, which would be 50 months, could be years. And that's not effective. That is not in line with what the board has directed for us and does not meet our goal of being more transparent and having better like communication with the public about what their floodplain boundaries are.
So you just put a line in there that says that this is for the purposes of the update, please be aware.
Megan, is not necessarily that we couldn't have the update, but that we need to make sure we're communicating it clearly.
Right, and a template would certainly help with that. Another thing too is what you guys approve for the boundary and what FEMA approves for the boundary does change. It often changes. So notifying them about a maybe when it is likely going to change just seems kind of like upsetting them before they really have a reason to be upset. Like, it may not even be that upsetting. It could be better, it could be worse. Like, it's just bringing things forward on a hypothetical situation that isn't even approved and finalized yet. So I think for major, it would certainly help after FEMA has said this is the line, then notifying everybody.
But it is approved and finalized. Like, once it's approved by the county, we treat that as the existing best available information.
What happens when FEMA approves a different line? What has to happen if FEMA approves a different?
So moving forward, we will probably ask that we get the new information. So that, but that's the other thing, is the property owner is going to get notified again at the FEMA process as well. So if the map does change as a result of any comments that FEMA has, that notification will be given to the property owner. So then when we update it, once it's been approved,
it's not going to be a surprise to that property owner that it's been approved and that their boundary is unchanged again or been updated again.
Is there, I understand, it makes sense, you know, wanting to be as transparently and as quickly as possible. It sounds like that's really a driving factor here on this. And, but I mean, why would we want to create the extra work?
Actually, it probably would be less work for us. So we have properties where a study comes in and changes the floodplain line just based on better information. And the staff hours that go into, like, that property comes up for sale, we have to talk to anybody that's coming in. Like, there is a level of outreach that has to happen one way or another. And we would prefer to do the outreach that makes it clear up front about the changes, as opposed to it not being clear to property owners.
But would you have to notify twice? I guess three times, right? We got the first county, hey, your floodplain's changing on your property, and then there's the FEMA notification, and then now you need to go change the county again.
No,
so are we notifying again?
It's just a two.
So there's not another.
So it's you notify them once the plan is approved by the county, sign the MT2 form. FEMA then has a bunch of comments. They never like the line. They make you change it.
Yeah.
And then you have to notify the public again, hey, line's changed again. And so to me, it just seems like there's always drama around moving a floodplain line. And you're just now dealing with twice as much drama. And I understand, like, all transparency is great. It's just, it seems a little inefficient of time when you're having to have the same conversation multiple times.
But there's also the situation where, like we were talking about, we might change it on the map, but say someone, their property, they didn't know that happened. Like, this is to tell them, hey, you know, study happened and now there's a different floodplain on your property. So we've had instances where when that has happened, it has changed something significantly and has impacted like the developable area of that property. And we couldn't change it on the map. Like this time we can change it on the map, but it's about notifying them so that they actually understand that something has changed on the map.
All right, Megan, I guess a better way of phrasing this is, so right now, if we wanted to do it, the reason we don't every time a study or an alteration, or I guess a study, the reason every time a study comes through, we don't update off-site is because it would take a ZMAP.
Right.
So think about like the level of effort required for a ZMAP. This is like, here's a letter. The floodplain administrator is going to get the questions. I'm willing to say I would rather get questions from applicants than go through a ZMAP every 6 months.
Right. I'm not saying anything about the ZMAP. I'm saying, like,
but that's what this is replacing.
Right. But you're already notifying them once FEMA approves it. So you're
right.
Doing it twice. So you're still satisfying notifying them that the boundary has changed.
It's the timing of it. That's our issue. Our timing is that it is not quick with FEMA. And it's not, honestly, not quick with applicants. Like, sometimes applicants are not as on top of submitting their LOMARs as, and if it's an alteration, you're talking date of completion, it could be years. So it's a timing issue. It's not a notification, like, yes, we eventually will have FEMA's notification, but at minimum, it could be 6 months to a year. And if a property goes up for sale, like right after that study's done, somebody could buy that and not have that notification, or we have not updated that map. Like, it's a timing issue of, like, how long it takes FEMA to get these processes done.
This is Jason. I have a question to Laura. What does the rest of that section say? Can you collapse the separation between the pages, please? Oh, so that's it. Okay. And my other question is, notwithstanding FEMA requirements, wasn't there board direction to provide this notification?
Yes.
Yeah, Maggie said that.
Okay. So, I mean, we're kind of stuck then with doing it.
I'm not saying not to provide it. I'm just saying if you're still providing it, you just provide it after FEMA has accepted the notification language.
I think we can address the concerns and the wording of the notification. I really do. I think
as long as people understand this isn't, we're sending them a notification. This isn't the final, final, final. You will get another notification from FEMA later when FEMA has approved it. I think we can work through the way that that is worded and make that a little more palatable for you, the public, so that they know what's coming. So they don't think that, oh, I got this notification. I'm never going to hear anything again. It's done. We can just make that very clear on that initial publication.
And for a study, it doesn't, the property owner's acceptance of a change due to a study is not, it's not pulled up the approval. Like an alteration is a little bit different, but for a study, we're not going to hold, like if the property owner doesn't agree, there's it with the study, their time to like right now, they can submit afterwards, they can submit their own information. So it would be the same. Like just because they don't accept that notification and they don't agree with the line doesn't mean we're going to hold up a study because of it. They can then submit their own study later on if they want to.
It's like an objection period?
No, we wouldn't have an objection period.
Because
it's based on new and better information. So if they feel like they don't agree with that information.
Like if the hydrology changes and there's like more flow, so the floodplain's wider in that area than it actually is. There's nothing they can do about it because if it's a detailed study, it is what it is. With an alteration, you can never widen it or make it higher without offsite permission. So the only situation you ever have is notifying them that it got smaller or didn't change.
Yeah. So it's not like they're agreeing or disagreeing to development. It's they're agreeing or disagreeing to the existing condition.
Ken, you had a comment.
Good job, Peter.
In this interim period between county approval and FEMA approval, which may have different lines, from the standpoint of transparency, when the county remaps in that interim period, are you somehow having a different line type or designation that this is a new line pending FEMA approval?
For a study, I don't think that has been discussed.
For anything.
An alteration,
yeah, that brings
it out.
I mean,
we're trying to be transparent, yeah. And we're showing something, I don't know, that's not been approved by FEMA.
Getting to in terms of formatting the notification.
That's the notification. Ken is talking about that, what you physically see.
Yeah.
A potential purchaser doesn't get the notification, obviously, that's on the map.
Yeah. You might want to think about
the map does say like, when you click into the phone line on any of this.
Megan, to answer your concern, the FEMA notification doesn't really have to be specific. All they're asking you is, are there any changes to SFHA? Are there any changes to BFEs? They don't ask you how much is the change, where is the change. It could be a generic letter to send out to all the property owners who get impacted. That would be the same letter you can send it to county. It could be generic to, I'm reading the notification. All it says is you just have to tell them if there's an increase or a decrease.
Right, yeah. So they have a template. And I guess what I'm trying to say is when individuals sometimes like to template up, FEMA comes back and says, no, like it. I can only have these words in it. Take away any flower. And you're like, all right, they're very specific. And in the past, when we had our own letters that added flower, it was a drama for the town. And then they went inside the MT2 farm and it was just a Lomar. Like there was something, just better data. So FEMA took it without the town signing it.
That's going to happen if you add more details to it. And it was the whole process for FEMA where they had to notify the maximum increase and maximum decrease in BFE and SFHA. FEMA got rid of that for that specific reason. They have a generic template now.
But I think from an owner standpoint, you can see the confusion about you get this letter from the county that says, hey, we've changed the floodplain on your property. And then all of a sudden, 3 months later, you get another letter from another agency that says, hey, I've changed the floodplain line on your property. Which I think your idea, Maggie, of phrasing it in a way that says this is coming is a great idea.
It's just, I feel like a lot, to Melanie's point, we can probably figure out how to communicate it to people appropriately. There's always going to be confusion.
Yep.
But if we figure out a way to like phrase it in such a way that you know, we make a template and that's what's required. Do we want to say something along those lines that the notifications can't just be sent out without the county's approval of what's in the notification?
You're at your own risk.
It's not your template. It's more work for you guys when we put in something really asinine and we're like, great, why did they say that?
You can send a draft.
I mean,
I know we can.
So I'm just saying,
well, I guess
advice for the county, it just doesn't seem. I think you would want to make sure you have buy off on that template and it's not creating problems.
So
especially since some engineers don't know how to write. So we could add it to the list. I mean, we've got, right, like on here, you've got title of a floodplain study, scale. We could put in draft of notification letter.
Or you just put it to be in a form approved by the county.
Something. Well, my guess is you don't want to submit that right before you're about to get your. You probably want to give us your draft, your letter before you're submitting your signatures.
You guys,
I would assume you wouldn't want to submit that, and then we'd be like, well, now we have more comments.
You guys get them.
Well, I would assume it's like not an official, like that stuff go back and forth through email versus uploading onto Landmark.
No, I everything is in Landmark now.
What do you guys receive now from a property owner notification?
We don't have one.
Not what do you guys send out? I meant, is this a requirement that we have to tell you that yes, it's been sent out and how?
So right now we don't have any property owner notification because it can be done through a DMAP. And so this is, since we're taking it out of an overlay, we have to have, you're adding.
You're trying to find a way to get the notification.
Yes, this is a new requirement.
Okay. I would think the form would be about the same every time with a couple minor details of what that BFE is, what that whatever is, specifics of the property. I mean, that seems like a template that you all could provide and fill in the blank, and then there's no confusion about second submission, third submission.
Yeah.
You know, slang word
major. Because the minor doesn't go FEMA, major does go FEMA, depending on what your situation.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So do you want this added, this number 22, draft property owner notification?
I think it's good.
Something
to be said. It doesn't need to be per owner. Like FEMA's is just, we don't give them every single individual owner. We just leave a blank for the owner name and a blank for property address. And then everything else, we just specifically say what changed. So I don't think staff has preference either way. It sounds like this would be more of a benefit to industry to avoid
drama.
Submit it, yeah. Drama with you and your submission, like to property owners. So I don't have an issue with it being added in there. It's just
the best submission appropriate.
The draft you can send it in, right?
You're
viewing it first before.
I think it's, I mean, I just would assume that because you need to send documentation that the letter has been sent out with your final submission. So it should be somewhere in between first submission and signature.
Well, I think that the documentation that it was sent out is different than
right.
The draft notification.
I agree. So that's, I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't know where you would put that.
I don't know enough, but my only thought was like, what if you submit the
values change or something?
Does it matter?
Usually, it tells us when to notify. Like, this is okay now, you can notify. So I almost feel like you guys need to give some sort of unconditional blessing and say, this is at a good state, you can start notifying it.
Yeah.
I really don't think it should be up to individuals' judgments in that, because you've got varying judgment in this area.
Why don't we put a pin in that and come back to it? Time you all can think about whether you want to propose a template or whether leave it open to industry to have, you know, multiple versions that require staff review every time.
Sure.
Sound fair? Everybody kind of think about it.
I stuck it under when it comes to a company floodplain studies, but I'll I like that.
Yes.
Where we start.
So we'll go through the rest of this next week, and then hopefully we'll be ready with chapter 5, and I guess that'll be October.
Okay.
We won't have it next week, I can tell you that.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, as promised, we're going to move on to the project roadway.
Well, I think the best way to start is to just do a recap, right? You know, where we left things. We introduced this a long time ago, and we were doing all this analysis on the new ordinance and the changes that were incorporated and what that means for us with the FSF. Originally, we had a strategy that was going to incorporate some sort of advisory opinion from the zoning administrator. Just as we were sort of wrapping that up, we really, when everyone got back together, we realized we were really stepping out of bounds as far as what the text actually says and what we've got in place, you know, right now. So we submitted actually when we introduced this to you guys, we got recommendations from the committee. We passed that on to zoning for their consideration, and we got verified that this section of the ordinance is in fact on the quick fix list. We don't know how quick that will actually be, but at least it's on, you know, in the queue to be revisited earlier. So with that said, we were going to incorporate an interim procedure that gets us up to that point, you know, in the future. It helps us, you know, gets the developers to establish a reserve fund, just as the ordinance says, with approval of the site plan or the record of plat. So then it was a question of how do we calculate that value? And that's pretty much where I think we left it back in July. So since then, Laura and I have been working, trying to work through some real world examples and develop some numbers on this. We've also been thinking about how the procedure could go, because we'll have to issue a tech memo on this thing that spells out how we'll go about it, how we'll verify, and when that happens. So I guess, do we want to jump into the spreadsheet now? Why don't you pull up your comparison first? So we got a hold of some real world examples where we were able to pull in the bonds, the original bond estimate that was done, and compare that with the reserve study that was completed before lots were being sold. And much to my dismay, we were struggling to really come up with a good correlation. I really thought it would pare down better than it did. I think we're finding that depending on who does the reserve study, that those strategies can be very different and result in different bottom lines. The other thing that come up internally is the discussion on what exactly this covers. So, being that it's the language that is reserve fund, are we trying to plan for contributions made during those first 10 years as if the reserve study was already done and we were already, you know, working towards that? Or are we talking about the scheduled expenses expected? Normal reserve studies are we're finding expects a certain amount of crack and seal repair and a little bit of concrete work. So we went through a lot of discussions on that. And Laura and I tried to kind of compare both scenarios and just was hoping we could have this discussion.
Sure.
That is where we're at.
I'm not sure I understand the difference between the two things that you're saying that you were considering. Can you say that?
We'll get there. I think what it really boiled down to was if we're thinking that it's reserves up to the first 10 years, and what would be built, then you're pulling in some bigger ticket items, where if it's just those initial expenses expected through the first 10 years, that left out a lot of the full mill and overlay costs and things like that.
Does that make sense? I have another way to explain it. There's expenses that you would incur in the first 10 years.
Uh-huh.
However, if you look at the life cycle of a element, a road, say has a 30-year life. If you wanted to cover your expenses over the course of that 30 years, you might want to be saving more during the first 10 years. So is it just the cost in 10 years, or is it your amortized, prorated cost for the life cycle during
that?
And sometimes it's helpful. For me, it was helpful to go back and look at the state regulations around those studies, which kind of describes that it's really a part of the annual budget language for these maintenance. And it's not just private roads. It's all in an HOA. It's all the capital stuff. And it talks about doing an annual budget and then programming your reserve studies accordingly to make sure that you have that. So it helped me to distinguish, Matt, the two by looking at what the state code was looking for as opposed to trying to define what 10 years of maintenance was. Define that.
Yeah.
So obviously we're talking about bigger numbers versus smaller numbers, and we acknowledge that. You know, it's just we're trying to stay faithful to what's in there and how we set this up to be correct. And so that's where we're at right now.
Yeah.
We did. So start with what elements are you, but you're still talking about pulling things from the bond estimates, correct?
Yep. Yeah. So when I had a staff member, like I said, map out the original bond estimate, just punch those numbers back into our spreadsheet that we have. And then we created another tab and just pulled the road items and the corresponding unit rates and values for that. And then we were just toying around with different percentages of that based on what the reserve studies were showing us.
So you're looking at the cost of full replacement, the bond estimate, and then trying to come up with what percentage would be like a maintenance cost.
Yeah.
Like 10% of a full replacement.
Yes. And that's proven to be way more of a challenge than I was expecting. So the 10-year reserve amount. It's just the tab there on the bottom. We had initially a lot more in here. But through talking, we decided to trim that down to hopefully be a little more straightforward. And also when it comes to culverts and such, you know, some of those are not going to be road related. We're really trying to get the heart of what we're after.
Sorry, guys, I was trying to get Jason's little block off there, but I'm failing.
It's strategically in the wrong place.
I'm failing miserably.
Can you get the minimize button? No, right.
I noticed you.
It's something about the view and.
That's right. We'll work through it. You can scroll.
I tried to click off. So. The new speaker is going to be worse.
Can you click on participants?
Click on people?
Yeah.
Okay. No place to hide. Okay.
The dot, dot, dot.
You can just scroll them.
All right, we'll scroll up when we get there. I mean, at least you're not going to need really specific numbers, but you need to look at those categories, right?
Yeah.
So we have, sorry, Derek, you had a question.
Yeah, we've been discussing mm-hmm. our examples. Well, the one to see that you kind of included there is the storm drainage one. I don't know if you want to dive into
it. We did. We took a lot of those out, but we left in the curb inlets because that's most likely going to be, you know, along the road. And the same with the drop inlets.
And the county responsible for maintaining storm pressures.
Yes.
A roadway, not for private streets. Not a private
street.
The easement clarifies. I think current template shows that the county responsible maintains the sewer system.
I think it is.
Okay, so let me just say, let's not go line by line on this right. Because the numbers have, we're going somewhere. We're going somewhere, and we can circle back and we can try individualize.
We found that, because we talked about it, we start pulling it, we're probably looking at bigger percentages, and that's fine. But we found that the correlations just start going haywire the more we got rid of, because we pulled, if you scroll down,
a very short list.
We took out.
That's a list. That's short.
So like, yeah, there were some other items, bigger ticket items in there that when we took that out, it just, we had nowhere to come back to. Everything diverged.
Like driveways, you could argue right here, residential driveways, take out that 254,100. When we start doing that, you're gonna do like 95% of whatever this figure is.
But if the dollar amount is the same.
It's not.
Okay.
Yeah, we tried. I promise. We tried.
No, that was a question.
What was the train of thought that you were going at?
If the dollar amount, if we have fewer things, but it's a higher percentage of the fewer things, is it the same as a lower percentage of more things?
Yeah, it's made me doubt my engineering. If we went from 76% to 20-some percent between the different examples.
But that percentage doesn't really matter. It's the, I think, it's the dollar amount that is the concern, question mark. There was a question mark at the end of that sentence.
I just try to line up so the percentages all...
A line up for the different types of projects. Yeah. Okay, that's where the percentage comes in. Okay.
It seems like we're trying to recreate a wheel right here. Have you reached out to the successful HOAs around here and tried to understand how they calculate their reserve studies? Because I don't see anything that we've ever done being this complicated.
So we have, you'll see this is going to be compared to the reserve study in just a minute. This is step one.
But have you reached out to Hepburn Farm, Hepburn Village?
Actually, Derek and Angela, members of our committee, provided several examples, and we have three examples, and we have the actual reserve studies and budgets, in some cases, for those HOAs.
And I think we can't just consider the Ashburn Farms and the Broadlands. We have to consider the 10-lot subdivisions on a private road that have 10 homeowners who have only a private road to maintain in their HOA.
Let's be real.
So it's got to work.
Yeah. Those are the ones we're actually concerned about.
I agree with you, Matt. I agree with you, Matt.
So, actually,
Okay, we derailed you. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead. We've derailed you.
Let's run a little bit further.
Yeah.
Okay. So, when you get to the end, guys, that has a total there, and there's a percentage, right? This percentage does not include any contributions toward the ultimate melon overlay that happens, say, in your 18 or 20. Okay, this is planned scheduled maintenance in the first 10.
Right.
Like a patch.
Yeah, the crack repair, the
ceiling.
The incremental concrete repair for the curb and gutter, and then that was it, right? It's curb and gutter is all we pulled.
So I'm going to switch views. Okay, now that you see sort of the spreadsheet and what you pulled, I just want to go back to where we were. So if you look at this, you can see we added the melon overlay at the end, okay? That's the big ticket item. It's estimated to be $346,564 in year 21. You need that total sum. We divided by 21, we annualized it, we multiplied by the first 10 years. We got this, you need to have $165,000 in your HOA coffers in that first 10 years to get you to the 346. What this does is this is a high percent, right? This is a big chunk of money. Ironically, despite that this was three different HOAs, three different reserve studies, three different bond estimates, they all came out at 14%.
Yeah.
So they were all 14%. Everything just lines up so beautifully. Everything is so pretty and kind and nice. But the number is really high.
But versus 7% if you did not include the ultimate mill and overlay.
Okay.
Is that just...
That's the gist. Okay. That's the gist.
This was 7%, it would equal that number. Not other sheet you just had up.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. And we have, he's got those sheets each set at 7. But seven. So when we have them here at the 14,
that's the 7%.
So it doubles if you ask them to budget for... What's going to happen in your?
Well, let me see which one I'm on.
Well, it's
2019.
It's confusing, and I think what industry is going to
push back on is the fact, like, all those line items that you had in the bond estimate aren't maintenance and repair of the road.
Yep.
So they're going to be like, why are we paying a percentage of the driveway aprons, of the, you know, the inlets? Like, I think it needs to be apples to apples as to what you're actually being required to repair. There's going to be a lot of confusion, I think.
I have another question that's first to sort of related. And Angela, does Toll contribute, once the HOA is created and you started to sell units and you're partially, but you're still controlled by the developer, are you paying into the HOA dues the amount for the lots that are still under builder ownership? Like, so you're going to get a budget year two, and I'll use one of the bigger subdivisions. Let's say it's a 500 lot subdivision. Year two, you've only sold, God willing, and the creek don't rise, 150 of those. Do you? So if they only 150 of the homes are contributing, even if we had that money at some year in time, are they getting behind because those other 350 units aren't there? Or do you, as the builder, contribute for those units? Did that question make sense?
Yeah, the budget that gets set up by, you know, our property management company or whatever is, the goal is that we don't, that they're funding themselves in time. Now there's circumstances like townhouses or condos where once the building's built, then those units are brought into the HOA. Until they're sold, you'd have to pay that month or two or whatever it is. But Derek, I don't know how you do it, but you know, hopefully the goal is that we would not be funding the HOA budget. And we're doing the maintenance while the roads, while we're constructing the roads before we get out bond. So, I mean, we are doing some of that maintenance already to get off bond, you know, within the first 3 years. Like, you notice the reserve study was until 2024. We sold out like before or at that time, right? So,
Hopefully the reserve study
was established once we turn it over, because now we aren't doing that work. So there's like a period of time where we're doing work for the HOA, you know, for those roads.
Hopefully the math people figure out that is a curve. And so they're not charging those original homeowners three times the money to do it, but they're budgeting, assuming they're only going to collect so much in
your year. Oh, yeah, our dues are like, you know, they go up at the beginning and then lower. The goal is, I mean, they go up a little bit, you know, over time.
Right.
But those first 10 homeowners aren't paying, like, I think it's exorbitant amount.
We give them our projections and then use those stats to develop how much each person is contributing.
Your projections of how you think they're going to sell.
Yes. And they use that to determine the HOA fee.
For the first so many years.
Yeah, they take it over time. Yeah, and then they redo it.
And they assume some level of vacancy.
It's based on like our pace, you know, and our settlement pace. Like how many units we're going to have each year. And then
I don't know that it's really related, but it helps my brain. Process all this.
On top of that, there's sort of two ways to help. Like, we, as a declarant and a developer, we doing all the maintenance. Like, we're plowing streets. Something breaks while we're there on bond, we're doing it. Some developers will fund the HOA and give them money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us, I don't know, I'm told us that we just do it ourselves. So we'll hire a landscape company, the snow plow. Something breaks, we'll fix it and manage it ourselves while we're the declarant. Some of them will fund the HOA and give them money to manage it.
And do your HOAs ever push back for, and is the reserve study what they push back for when you actually turn over the majority of the HOA to them? In other words, there's some tipping point where they gain control, really.
Typically, they're good at these projections. So when you're buying, you know what the fee's going to be. You're a homeowner buying, you're paying $400 a month. They've done the projections, so you're not surprised when you get in there. Typically, they're pretty accurate with that. Sometimes, they can get underfunded, though, and they have to raise assessments on them.
I don't think with your escrow and your mortgage.
Storm damage. We had a tornado come through and tore up the community center. You're going to have a special assessment to rebuild that thing.
Yeah.
And again, that works great in the larger developments that you all are building, but that 10-lot subdivision if there is storm damage.
We're regional, but this, that you got, you found a number.
Yeah.
You found a number.
No, I know, but go ahead.
We have two numbers.
You found two options.
Sorry, I didn't mean to pull us off track. It just helps me process the number.
Three of the number. Idea is that it would pull off the bond estimate. And we did that, Angela, because the zoning ordinance said it's based on the design engineer's estimate, but you guys don't have a reserve study by then. That's why we were tying it to this thing. The idea is automatically populate into this other tab, and that our people could pull that value at either when they approve their bond estimate, I'm thinking, or actually the approval letter to communicate, you know, this is the 10-year amount based on the private roads, right? And then under the ordinance, we would need to verify that there's some kind of escrow in place as well. Some of the conversation before the record plat is approved or the site plan is fully approved.
So we're getting, who's that going to?
An escrow account.
Just an escrow account.
Yeah. We got to figure that part out.
Yeah.
But the theory was the developer would be able to recoup that money.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a one-time donation by the developer and they pay for 10 years of maintenance.
Right, that's my next question.
The HOA is going to be building up, and then at some point, you would show that they built the reserve funds.
Yeah,
get your escrow back. That's so, it complicates it, but
I guess the only thing I see with this seems like a little unfair is like we're asking for a lump sum payment, even if it's going into escrow or whatever. I mean, not that like you know we're not here at $5 billion companies, but like you know if the HOA was doing that, they wouldn't be doing a lump sum payment, right? It would be annualized.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a.
It's just the words in the zoning ordinance that there is words.
Yeah, we're open to strategy that works.
Why?
And then
what word in the zoning ordinance says that? It
says that.
We have to. Well, I know it says that, but why does it need to be, you know, this escrow and help me understand this.
That was requested by the development community. He represented
it. It's a good thing to have an escrow versus just giving them the money.
Okay. So it's the developers.
But their stack is it's commencing with the initial plat. That's where I think the stats come back and said we have to have something at this moment in time.
Is there some sort of application at 10 years that has to happen to get that escrow released?
It's bad.
Right. We weren't thinking on being a part of that.
No. That's automatic. So this is still being developed, but the idea was you put the escrow in the declaration of covenants. Okay, put an escrow in there, and it's there are terms. And in fact, we would like to work with industry on a template for how this would be written, so the county attorney's office can check this box in this interim period, and it would say something to the effect of. The declarant, that applicant, the developer is going to post this amount of money, and it would give the terms that it will be reduced as the HOA collects fees towards the other piece that's going to be in the declaration. And the ultimate fix to this problem is, and Rick Stone was a big help on this, it's a private street maintenance fund requirement. So the HOA is going to have to create and establish a fund for private street maintenance that they're going to have to fund based on the reserve study. So these two things kind of blend together. And as you have both of those in the declaration, then you know, the terms will be outlined and the county will not be involved in this.
And another way to kind of do that rather than put all the terms in the land records is that covenants would refer to a separate agreement that might or might not be recorded that would outline, you know, what that money's for. How the HOA can return it. It's obligated to. I don't know. Those are details we still have to work out. But I think we have to be careful how much we put in a covenant that's in perpetuity.
Yeah, it was.
We can refer to.
It wasn't going to be that detailed.
Yeah. But anyway.
So for more context, like what was the issue to have triggered this 10-year thing?
You guys keep asking it, but we will never know the answer to it. We believe it's a CTP.
Okay, so if we don't really have an identified issue, the seriousness of this number we're coming up with for this temporary solution isn't like we're killing anyone if it's
a number or less, right? Because we actually trust the current system being done on the new HOAs. We're happy with it. This is just procedural. So it's a lot of money. Is there a way where, for procedural sake, we could adjust this bond estimate so it's not just, like, make it smaller?
So it's not procedural, as Matt and I kind of alluded to, for that 10-lot subdivision that needs 10 years to build up their reserves. They have 10 families contributing. They don't have the benefit of some, you know, and in some cases, those developers.
I mean, they're going to base it on there's not a lot of roadway for 10 lots. I mean,
hopefully.
I mean, that fund, like that HOA, whether it's 10 lots or 300 lots, should be budgeting for those repairs.
So this 10-lot subdivision, those homeowners get in there and they now control their HOA, and they see the developer has this big reserve fund they had to set aside in the county trustee somewhere. And they say, oh, we're going to artificially reduce our HOA dues and we'll grab that reserve money at the end of 10 years.
No, I don't think that's ever the intent. And I think there are ways that you can preclude that. I just think we can't ignore the number of phone calls that the county gets. You're right, Angela, they probably should. But we can't ignore the number of calls that the county gets. And I think that's partially where this came from as well. Hey, why can't my road be accepted? It's really expensive. It's way more expensive. We just thought we were pushing snow. I pay tax dollars too. And so I agree. It is not the developer's obligation to fund their decision. But clearly, at some point in time, a flat recordation, there needs to be enough money there for 10 years of maintenance. And so we're just trying to navigate that.
A very clear note on the plat. Did you require us to put on the plat that says that the road is privately maintained and not a public responsibility?
Yeah. How many people follow the rules and everything we do?
I think by having the 10-year reserve, all that does is defer that phone call to year 11.
Probably. But at least, you know, again, is part of the reason we don't know.
How do you apply this to a project like Loudoun Station, which is a mixed-use development? There are no individual homeowners. And
yeah, you would take the bond estimate and you would apply some factor and come up with a number. And then this, like a Loudoun Station has probably millions of dollars reserves. You would just show that our reserves above this escrow amount and you wouldn't have to do anything.
What if I were starting from scratch right now?
If you were starting from scratch, you'd have to escrow it for the phase you're working on that plan. And then when their reserve got high enough, you would get your escrow back.
Or how do I get it back? That's my concern, is how do I get it back?
We have to work through that.
Is there a scenario getting the escrow back, is there a scenario where, like, the proof of the reserve fund is established and going, and that's enough to say, okay, this escrow amount can be released because you have established?
That's the idea. Every year it's going to go up, and even the escrow, I feel like, could go down.
Yeah.
So, like, you know what I mean? You're here. If the HOA contributes, this escrow comes down. It goes away. It just keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until it's gone.
But I get Dave's concern is that this HOA, big or small, sees dollar signs. And I know HOAs think developers are, you know, leaving them with a
pot of gold.
Pot of gold. So I get that. So, and we have to make sure we address that, because I think.
Does the escrow account actually go into their? It's always the developers, right?
I talked to our attorney about that very concern. Like, you just give an escrow to an HOA and we're no longer declared. They have this bond escrow, but we have to ask for it back. Not a good situation to be in. She had recommended, you know, like, it's an escrow that is in the developer's name, or it's a third-party title company that then is the...
That was my perception, Angela. Like, when you go to settlement, you put your, you know, there's an escrow agent that whatever escrow funds related to the settlement are put in, it's only a couple of days, it's not years. But, and then once the settlement is completely done and the funds are realized and all of that, it's dispersed appropriately. And that's kind of what I had in mind, was the third party escrow agent, where neither the HOA nor the developer had free rights to those funds. And that escrow agent is the one that would do what Laura was describing. Okay, the HOA provides proof of what they have in their coffers, and the developer says, okay, based on that proof annually, now I think this escrow can be reduced by this amount, and maybe those conditions are outlined in an agreement with the escrow agent, how much each year, depend, you know.
So the concern that was raised to us and our group was that, you know, this works really great when the declarant or the applicant is in control, right? But they might not be in control for long enough to recover the sum of money if we set it the bar too high. And it gets sticky. It gets sticky.
Not if you have an escrow agent.
Well, I mean, wouldn't they have our money for 10 years when we're gone? I mean, get into the, you know, pro forma and the way that this money then gets seen on our balance sheets and Wall Street. I mean, it's money out the door. So,
but also,
while we get it back, there's not a huge benefit. You know, like, there's repercussions on that big amount, tens of thousands of dollars versus hundreds of thousands of dollars out the door at record class. Big deal.
Yeah. And yet, I think the other difference between the big developers and the 10 unit ones is the 10 unit ones may do their thing, do it in a couple of years, and liquidate that corporation, and they won't be around in 10 years. So, who's the owner of the escrow if it's a small?
They're saying it'd be a third party, so it wouldn't be the HOA.
Has the builder, the developer ever get it back? There may not be a builder, it may be a developer that goes in and builds it. But the lots don't sell off, and the HOA isn't, I mean, the developer's an LLC. Who
goes right. So they can come from the HOA and be required to do a reserve study. I want to change
our. I'm not saying if they're not an HOA. Say it's a small LLC. They built the 10 houses, they sell them all, and they close down that LLC. They don't intend to be around in 10 years because they've moved on.
Well, then they leave their pot of money behind.
Well,
it's not a stay in business if you want to ask for that.
Yeah. Well, they create a lot of
things. Go out of business.
From a liability standpoint, we roll through LLCs all the time.
Yeah.
At some point, we close it down once the project's done.
So this is good because we're angling towards where I wanted this conversation to go, which is now we know all the details, right? So, what is the right dollar amount? And ironically, I'll just tell you something. Before we put the Milanova plan, it was about 7% of his estimate. And it roughly equated to what Angela's been dying for us to do, $10 per square yard of payment.
Question.
But the minute you put the Milanova land, forget it. Then that equates to $24 a square yard for the example on the top left, and $19 a square yard for the example on the right, and $15 per square yard in the bottom.
Well, the moment you put snow getting in there for snow removal.
So we're talking about an escrow, and then at the end of 10 years, the developer gets the money back.
Or as the reserves are built up, you can lower the escrow.
Yeah, right.
They can keep.
What's the, so that sounds like the HOA can't use that money. It's up.
That's the whole
point. Then what's the point?
The point is like, have a mechanism to
so I think
go
that,
in and
I think
right. So then in which case would they
could be, there could be clause in the escrow agent's agreement that allows them to prove emergency, and we could define that again in that.
Well, that's a whole new can of worms.
Yeah.
How do you go get that money where you're getting that? You so, the county?
No, not the county, the HOA.
I would
stop all the
done.
What?
Well, I thought
that. Once we take all your money, we're gone.
What if it, what if the escrow was
not
actually
all the money.
Used?
I'm kidding.
Okay, so I mean, now I understand that the county doesn't get to see these things or approve these things, but like, I mean, we have to. So we're trying to address something that we have to do, but I guess like in my mind, I don't understand why like. We were talking about like, oh, we got to hold it with an escrow agent for 10 years and all this stuff. Like, if if the whole point is that we're not really trying to create something that the HOA can actually utilize, okay, I think like that is a baseline. Then I don't understand why once the HOA has been established, they've got a budget. That budget should be appropriately addressing both their operational needs and their capital reserve fund needs. That once that's in place, that this reserve, that this 10-year reserve shouldn't be immediately returned to the developer, because like at that point, again, first of all, this is, you're not expecting to need that money up front. This is what would happen over a 10-year period. And once that budget has been established, then that should be covering. If it is not, then they're not budgeting correctly.
It depends on who's doing the maintenance.
So, you know, I keep coming back to the language in the zoning ordinance, and it says have an established reserve fund sufficient for maintenance and repairs of the road for 10 years.
But it doesn't say how long the fund has to exist.
Why couldn't it, yeah, why couldn't that fund dissolve at the time?
I just struggle with understanding why anybody would ask for a reserve fund to be established and then give it back.
For HOAs to separate from their reserve fund specific for the road? Because like they can use it for fixing a pond, fixing anything else.
And we can't, so
no, that we are doing that. That's in the declaration. That's the long-term fix, and that's the other piece of the declaration is going to set up a road maintenance fund.
Right. So
that those road maintenance monies can all be used for road maintenance. I don't think they said they couldn't use it. I think what we talked about with Angela and Derek was that they're doing the maintenance. So the HOA is not coming for them and saying, I need to take $20,000 out of escrow because I need to patch a hole over there.
I think it has to be a 10-year maintenance sustained throughout the duration, I guess is what I was saying. Not why would we have a regulation that creates it and then gives it back. What I mean is that if you could find a way for your HOA to have that 10-year reserve fund at plat recordation, and I'm being facetious when I say that, but if you could propose to us a way that HOA could do that, then maybe that answers the question.
Like, you're in a bigger HOA, like Brambleton, they're never even going to put this in the script. Because they're going to hand us a piece of paper that says,
and that might
we have $3 million. We exceed your estimate by
10 times. It doesn't say who has to establish it. It just says that all private roads must be designed, blah, 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 have a recorded protective covenants, blah, 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 and have an established reserve fund sufficient for maintenance and repairs of the road for 10 years as determined by the design engineer's estimate commencing with the initial record
plot.
Well, I got a question on that, though. Why can't you contribute 10% every year for 10 years?
Because it says it has to have a 10-year reserve fund sufficient for maintenance initial record plot.
Right.
Then you have to have a fund sufficient.
But the definition of sufficient could be, it's enough to slowly put money into your 401k so that in 50 years you can then retire. Versus, I need to have all the $3 million now so that in 50 years I can retire.
To me, the fund has to be established, not that it has to be fully funded up front.
It says sufficient for 10 years.
And in 10 years, if you contribute 10% every
year. No, it doesn't say in 10 years, it says sufficient for 10 years. So maybe we do
money.
I don't know.
Seed money. It's intended to be seed money.
Do we know?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Dollar amount is not seed money. I mean,
right.
That's half the cost of mill overlay. That's significant.
I've lived in my house for 20 years and fixed the crack once. So it's Vita. I mean, this is insane.
Well, that's
so
what
we
need. Build public roads. We're going to have a problem.
That doesn't mean that the
make them a little easier to build.
They may be. That's another agency down the street.
This is the interim because it says those words commence.
So obviously the 7% is more powerful than the 14%. I mean, I think it's universal. You guys can tell me if I'm talking out of turn. 7% is more palpable. It doesn't include any contributions toward the mill and overlay. It just doesn't.
Well, it's 7% of what? This whole bond estimate?
Yeah, but not really the bond, the road on this. I got it. So they're alluding to it, right? Where there's a period, and are we
Is it a 10-year period or the first 10-year period? Like, what's the
interpreting it, I think, as the first 10-year.
Okay.
We look at the reserve studies, and that doesn't include the mill and overlay.
Where's the reduction for I'm holding a bond that can do this?
That's where it goes.
The bond
has to be.
Well, I, you know.
That's the ultimate fix.
Your pain.
My concern is we're in an era where everybody's trying to find affordable housing, trying to keep housing costs down. As a developer, if you tell me I got a folks got $100,000 road fund and I got 100 lots, I can tell you I'm adding $1,000 to every one of the cost of those lots. Yep. Because as the each lot goes to settlement, I'm going to get my $1,000 back right then and there.
Yep.
Which is why this is an interim, keep in mind, this is the interim solution.
So, but you're raising the price of the house.
Yep. No, and that's why we're
houses don't come back down.
So our discussions, if you guys don't know by now, we owe a huge debt of gratitude to Eric and Angela meeting with us and educating us and taking the time, you know, to show us all the studies and work with us. And it seemed like we were on the same page when we included the items with the exception that were really programmed in the first 10 years, like year five. We're going to do some matching, and then 5 years later, we're going to do some matching, and we're going to do 5% of the curve. Like, everybody was happy, right? We were all like, okay, this all seems reasonable, shakes out around 7%, but even better, it shakes out around $10 per square yard, which is something Angela and Derek both said. You can get this into a dollar amount per square yard, life would be really good.
Well, Laura, a little bit, I don't know that $127,000 is what I think is a lot less than that. That patching and repairs.
It was.
Yeah. When we worked that particular example, I think that we were trying to correlate.
Yeah.
No, it was.
It was 96.
Can I ask you?
But the problem was we had some percentage problems. It was 5% of yours and 7% of one of Derek's and 8% of another of Derek's. So we were like.
And that can be, I mean, that's.
So we came up with 7.
What are these scenarios?
The scenarios are, if you look at this, okay, so Regency at Belmont is one of the projects. First, we started looking at just these items. So we added up 35,000, 40,000, 20,000, right?
Those are from the reserves.
And if I scroll down, that totaled 96,000.
Okay.
That was 5% of Zeb's bond sheet.
Okay.
Just to keep it like, are we correlating? Now let's go to the next project, right? Now, what I did is I did include an example of the mill and overlay annualized. That bumped it up by 165,000.
Okay.
That's why you're seeing, actually, no, the contribution would be 261 instead of 96.
Okay.
If we include like 10 years contribution for mill and overlay, ultimate mill and overlay in year 18, 20, 21, you know, they're perfect way for
your savings.
So then we go over here, and then we go to the next example. And you can see the lots here. We have 105 single-family attached over here. We have 144 single-family detached. You see the square yards of roads. Okay. This one has more square yard of road back. The first thing I did was I took this one. Okay. This is the variation in reserve studies. Oh, we're only going to patch once in 10 years. We don't need to patch twice. Okay, well, that's a huge difference, okay? That's a huge difference in the dollar amount for us to try to reconcile into a percent. And that's what we're like going crazy. So if I just took the asphalt seal coat and the concrete curb and gutter, we ended up down with 147,470. This is a neat 7%. If I start throwing in the mill and pave in this case, you see the different prices. Angela's had less, but she allocated more towards her mill and overlay. This project had 4,000 more square yards, and they allocated less.
Is that because they're doing like different thicknesses?
That jumps it up to 291,000. So that's the ultimate security, right? That's you're giving the ultimate protection, right? You're giving them 10 years towards the mill and overlay.
Do we have a linear footage of each one of these? Like,
but
one on the right's 1,000 feet, 1,200 feet on the.
We talked about square yards.
Give us that.
Square yards.
Which are better.
Like some are very.
We're trying to get it to just like, if this many square yards in front of roads, it's X dollars per square.
Yeah, it's what I was trying to figure out. You do for linear foot road, but if you do it, it's in a square yard.
What is really an exact?
$50 a linear foot. There you go. Got it.
It's, he got to linear foot. I got to linear foot too, because the roads are all roughly 22, 24. But most of the time.
No, I want a small as possible.
Yeah.
So that was an interim fix, right? This is an interim fix that we're arguing about?
It is interim.
Okay, why don't we just do one thing of seal coat and crack fill and figure what that is, or 1%. I mean, this is a Band-Aid we're talking about.
Well, and I wanted to ask about the functional part of that. So like, this is an interim fix. We're assuming the ordinance gets fixed. Let's be optimistic that it gets fixed. Within the next 6 months. Okay. So like, I mean, if there were any, subdivisions that got caught up in this, like, how are we going to address that? Like I said, just like, if you get caught in the middle of all this, oh, well, too bad, so sad, or like, are we going to go back and retroactively say like, hey, okay, this has been fixed. Like, you don't, like,
you can have your money.
At least to this obligation, you can claim your escrow back late.
Let's see what the long-term solution is before I answer that question.
Can we wait for the long-term solution before we implement a quick fix?
No.
Well, we should talk to all those people who are heading up on this and get different projects approved into waiting.
Here's the thing. While you're figuring out the long-term solution, whatever solution you find temporarily, are you guys going to say, we really like this, so let's make this permanent?
Yeah, that's not the intent.
But
you don't know
what works.
Zoning could do that.
I mean, how many times has that happened? I feel like here's a temporary solution. It's been working. Let's just keep it. Why fix what's not broken?
I don't think we think even a temporary solution in this case is not broken. And I think, quite honestly, there's bigger issues with private roads. And that's why that's more what I'd be concerned about, is that the whole discussion of private roads and maintenance thereof and use thereof, it could get caught in that and delay it. That's what I'd be more.
I'm concerned it is going to delay it, but I haven't really heard, like, you guys keep talking about this 10 lot thing, but I'm under the impression that you're always required to have an HOA when you subdivide land. You're not? That's not a law anymore?
I wish it was. That's one of the questions I'm asking.
Like, when you
if there's no, if there's no common.
Says have recorded protective covenants.
You'd have to have a maintenance agreement.
You would have to have a maintenance agreement and covenants. You don't need an HOA to do that. Okay. You can have
covenants. Number associated with that?
Like, excuse me?
There's a number associated with that. Like, once it's a subdivision, it's like anything more than two lots considered a subdivision. Like, isn't there a number trigger? So like,
why is an HOA?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
If you're sharing a road, you need a maintenance open space.
Anytime there's common owned land and an easement of a private road is not
road over a subdivision. Like, when you just like a private road to one lot is a driveway.
What about a 10-year fund for a maintenance agreement?
What if you didn't have an HOA declaration, you would address it in the maintenance agreement?
Yeah, the maintenance agreement we talked about. I mean, I've seen communities that maintenance agreement actually appoints a treasurer and a bank, and it goes into really big detail about who's contributing. But it's not an HOA, it's a maintenance agreement that has, it's not regulated by the state in any way.
I think the 10 lot thing too, the thing that Cliff said you have to look at, that's why I think the lower number is good. Imagine you're a 5 lot family subdivision, you get a post of $50,000 escrow.
I know.
That would be hateful, I know. For your own road.
Sounds like the county staff is maybe over 7%, but that doesn't account for the time value of money over that 10 years.
Yes.
It's easily going to double in 10 years. Just
that's what's missing in the city is that the road is not 10 years old, that it's built at the record flat most commonly. Like, that's what this is not in the light until
right.
The election, but 4 years after the record flat.
Well, I can't say for sure we're comfortable 7%. I mean, we have to have this discussion. Is it appropriate to include the mill and overlay? I know what the committee feels.
I think at some point the state code clearly takes over responsibility as requiring these.
Yeah, it's been the timing problem with the state because versus what they wrote in the study.
Right. Yeah.
So how do we account for what you're saying.
Establishing.
So.
Assuming an annual percentage rate and.
So we can, are you trying to say we could go comfortably with the 7% because of the time value of money you're going to, it's going to build over time and get you closer to a mill and overlay anyway?
No, I'm saying I don't like mill and overlay to begin with. It's 7% cover enough for 10 years, and then we ought to factor that at year one, you don't need to put in that full amount for 10 years. It should be a prorated amount to account for the interest.
So you want to reduce the 7%.
Yeah, that's my suggestion.
To account for the money being lost.
Yeah, you know, you have the inflation factor. You have a present value factor.
We're going to support either. I don't think
I mean,
yeah, I don't know. It means the intent
of
that.
So you don't have to put in this one is 54,000 with. That's with the mill and overlay. This is the smallest one we have. It's 23.
Right.
And without,
it's also 3 years ago,
it's only 30,000. So, Kevin, are you suggesting they put in $8,000 because over 10 years? I mean, what's the point in doing it? Like, at some point, it's,
well, the money's going to sit somewhere and it's going to better earn interest.
Well, right? Who's getting the interest? We haven't talked about that. Maybe the developer's getting the interest.
How do you get the money? I don't understand how the money.
On the escrow. I don't know who's getting that interest. I don't think there's a guarantee the developer's not going to say, okay, that interest goes into this account.
It's a lot of things. Yeah.
Why? How do
we didn't ask him to put away the interest in.
How do you get this money? How do you force the money to go repair the road?
Exactly. I don't understand. So that would be, we talked about like a third party. Is that?
It would have to be in the agreement. So the agreement, we haven't gotten to that stage yet.
Yeah.
We're just trying to figure out which
we can get. Number.
Yeah, we've got it.
But this, if you don't know how you're going to get the money, what's the point of doing this? There's no way to go force someone to
pay. Make sure there's way.
The other option is you just write a check.
And that's not going to apply, right?
Right. We've got to come up with an option.
Back up to like the ultimate scenario, right?
Yes.
The fix that we want, whether it's, HOA can be required to set up this fund, build over time, set it aside. Like, I don't know, is there a way like that, establishing that language now takes the intent of this? I know we've gone through the reserve study that we require, but now it's in the covenants that they have to fund this. But maybe they're putting it in whatever fund or.
Have you heard back
for the road over time?
Your memo. Do you need the word mechanism to address that? Right. Have an established reserve fund mechanism sufficient?
Right, like establishing it, making the requirements to to fund it.
Yeah.
Over time, but that's
your proof of how you're doing this. I assume that be sufficient.
Best interpreting it that way says to have either.
But that is the way I'm interpreting it.
Well, I think what you're saying is what I was trying to push initially, and
yeah,
this says
no. But Betsy's being stubborn.
I know,
and they're not giving us
driving seven,
and that's what we want. You don't want them to
think. And I don't know, every avenue we've taken, prove that my interpretation is wrong has hit, pardon the pun, a dead end. And so I don't know. I haven't heard anything yet, and I'm open to something that convinces me that establishing a reserve fund sufficient for maintenance and repairs of a road for 10 years, as determined by a design engineer's estimate, none of it makes sense.
What if I'm a design engineer and I prove to you that on year one, the road doesn't need any money, so I'm 1 year old. I can prove to you that as the road ages, it needs more money.
So reserve fund is the word in there that kind of takes that away. My understanding, and I think we all agree, the intent of the reserve fund is that that money is being amassed so that when it's time to do it, the HOA isn't hit with that they are planning for the known Maintenance.
With the word reserve means it's established over time and commensurate with the age of the growth.
Yeah, fund being the pot, it's just a question of how full is the pot.
Last time I brought that up like, you know, months ago, it was just like, are we, I mean, can't this just be like an account when it's open that, look, that's going to get money put into it that
we established it at.
And again, you know, this is the.
So I want to circle back, Angela. I'm thinking about what you said. I just took a minute. I think the answer is no, because the quick fix change to the ordinance is going to require that fund to be established in declaration. The way the ordinance is written now, I don't think we can say that's.
I don't think that the quick fix language change necessarily, I have to reread it, precludes what Derek just kind of proposed, because they're creating a reserve fund. What he's saying is sufficient, and I think somebody else said it, maybe Brandon, sufficient at year one is $10. Obviously, it's not $10, but that the problem is that there's no mechanism in here to go back and check if for the first five, you put $10 in there, and obviously that's not, for the first 5 years for microplat, you probably don't have many homes sold. You're going through the administrative process review, you're going through approvals, you're clearing land, you're getting, I mean, you don't have somebody in those houses. Okay, maybe it's 3 years, but it's not year one, two, or three from record plat that you have somebody. So now we have $10 in there and we're at year three and it hasn't been advanced in any way commensurate with the amount of time that's passed. Should it have been done normally?
But I will commit in the declaration to requiring the HOA to do that for that 5 year period.
And the HOA you're saying for the first 3 years is you?
Well, I'm saying yes. The HOA, as people settle and start using the road, will contribute.
But then we were talking about in the declaration, well, no, to answer it, we were talking about that the declarant would
Right now,
that funding until it transitions.
Right now, the problem is that we're pointing out is there's one giant reserve pod that we will, you know, commit. That we'll have a separate plot just for private roads and put that in the declaration. Come up with a design estimate that reflects the road is only 1 year old or 0 years old, really, when we establish the record plot.
Maybe negative 2 years old.
Yes. That money could be a very small amount, but require in the declaration that this fund is attributed to with the HOA asking to move in and use the road and the road ages.
And by the declarant. That's what Rick proposed.
By the HOA.
Okay, so that's different. He's saying when the declarant's under control, they make that annual contribution for the reserve study. But that's almost forcing you then to not maintain it.
Most of the time now, the people moving in are making the cut. The declarant is doing the physical maintenance.
So that has to be clarified.
Well, because the security of the county, the declarant still has a bond.
Yeah.
So they're still
risk
doing
work now on some. I mean, the bigger subdivisions, I'm not really worried about because they're established. They have funding. Right. It's all there. Right. How does it work? Because we all know sometimes private roads, when you're moving, so the builder goes in and builds, the developer goes in and builds that private road. Lots are recorded. He sells to individual builders, individual property owners, however that would work. And now every homeowner is coming in with heavy construction equipment for the first 3 or 4 years. The developer is gone in this case, with his fund being
the the houses are still under construction. That road's not final topped.
Yeah, it's not.
Yeah.
He has a bond, and he has typically have like a security deposit with the builders.
You're also confusing developers that are sold to individual property owners. Do we don't hold the bond until every house is built on that road?
Yes, you hold the bond until me as a developer ask for it back, and I'm not going to ask for it back until I final top. I'm not going to final top until the last person's got his occupancy permit and gives a signature.
And maybe I'm making up a one in a billion thing that happens, and shut me up if I am, but I'm talking about the situation where somebody goes in and he builds a road, sells lot to individual property owners who come back in and build their house. He's off bond.
Like a boy.
Yeah. Well, and I have to say, there's one near me like that, and there are probably 30 lots marked. They've sold three. That road is deteriorating. It's never been finished, and we're going on, I don't know, 20 years.
I think there's one out in South.
Bill, the smaller developments, they don't make a lot of money by just creating a road for just 10 lots because they make their money back by actually being a builder and building the house and making profit on the house. So like even the subdivision, the clients aren't really developers where they're just putting in the infrastructure and selling the lot. They're the builder too. And so they care about all of it because they make their profit when they build the house, not so much as the infrastructure. And so they then try to recoup it when they get a homeowner on board.
And so maybe that's a historic problem, not a future problem. We're just not seeing that very much anymore. But as Elizabeth said, I know it happened. I know it did happen. That doesn't mean it still does. I think the model of development is very different than it was.
Right.
I also think there's been a lot of changes, not just with the model, but like when you're saying HOAs aren't a requirement, I don't know a situation where new subdivisions don't have an HOA. Like it is typically, regardless of whatever the laws are, there's a shared common space, you usually end up requiring it. Old subdivisions have the covenants where there's like a citizen association without an HOA. But like from my understanding, when we've spoken to our builders, they're basically, there isn't a way to go back to those covenants because those are a lot more lenient for owners. They're forced into an HOA. So we have been able to exploit the options of just the covenants because it's just made it not possible. So every subdivision now, whether it's three or, well, not three, of a certain size, I know that requires an HOA that has to agree to any shared private or public space.
Where do we go with this? Does staff want to kind of take all this in, or are there committee members that are willing to, you know, put three sentences together of, we got to have something to work from. I mean, this has been a good discussion about framework, where it comes from, some ideas of where to draw to compare costs, but I think we need something as a couple proposed, maybe needs to be both.
I told them we were given a pile of sand and asked to make a statue.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It's really.
It's written. It's a paragraph. Yeah.
What?
It's a poorly written paragraph.
Oh, it is. It is.
But it's very. Mm-hmm. It's
worthened by the fact that nobody remembers why it was added.
Well, the other thing is we only have a week between our next meeting, right?
Yeah, what are we doing next week?
Talk about where it is.
Same agenda.
And we're doing this next week.
This ends the top rate puzzle. The same agenda.
Next week. Not 2 weeks from now.
It's next week, yeah.
Back to back.
It's my fault.
Whatever we do, we have to come up with a number. I just request that, if possible, we have a bigger sample size to.
Oh,
I know. Like, if you think about three, like,
I'm not sure that we've reached. We'll talk before next week, because at the end of the day, yes, there's a number, but that number depends on this conversation and what its intent is, and that's what we keep. That's why I feel like I'm spinning my wheel.
Well, let me throw something else out. The language says per the design engineer's estimate. You can bail on this thing and say, Brandon, you need to give us an estimate.
I don't know if I feel comfortable. Well, I just read your fund estimate. I don't want to do that.
The thought was to try to get some structure here so we don't have
balls down here. Sorry.
Is there a way to get a survey of where it is a problem? Like,
no
way of getting things?
No, I don't think so. We could try, but.
Can we do a homework?
Don't take off what you don't want.
I don't have a bigger time, not a square yard.
Because I'm a designer.
I think there should be another
problem. It's not
arbitrary.
What a dollar number for square yard.
That's you.
I mean, you said that you had gotten pushed back on your interpretation of
this.
Oh, no, no, but Kevin and Pete. Kevin and Pete, and you guys don't want to meet the bill.
I say that somewhat facetiously. I mean, again, I think that
conversations.
The pushback I'm getting is my desire to really have it be a reserve fund sufficient for maintenance and repairs for 10 years. And in the definition of a reserve fund, that is to have the money necessary, in my interpretation, to consider everything that you need at the 10-year mark. That's the way I'm reading that.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm getting the pushback. And I get it, because that can, I could read that five times and probably come up myself with six or seven interpretations.
Yeah, and is there any scenario where we could change her?
Right. Opinion? You know, what is necessary at 10 years? Is
yeah.
It, you
know? Well, the fact that the fund builds, I thought that was the best point.
Absolutely.
The fund builds, it maybe that is what they should say. If you want to build that thing, say, I'm going to put $127,000 in, which is $10 per square yard or 7%. But by year 10, somebody do that math.
Yeah.
That's going to be... I can't do that math.
Well, nobody can do that math. That's forward perfecting. You don't know what interest rate you can make assumptions.
Yeah. Well, Chris, and every reserve study has to make assumptions.
Correct.
Yeah. Sometimes you've looked at other counties, Fairfax, what other people are. Does anyone have anything in this area?
Not. So I know Fairfax at one time had, and I don't think it was for private roads, because they really allowed very, very few private roads in Fairfax, especially for subdivision. It's townhouses, it's commercial, they're very limited. But for a while before 2014, they had a 20-year escrow you had to post for maintenance of BMPs that were not accepted. They were called something, but when you did non-traditional BMPs, like when the what were the ones saying over the collapses with the milk crate?
Yes.
You had to post a 20-year maintenance
or tanks.
in an escrow for the HOA, and I think that was a payment. I think that was actually. I don't think it was like
something that nobody else.
I'm going to talk to our meeting is adjourned. All right.